This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. With one interview, an author from London, and another one here in the studio. I'm going to be talking in just a few seconds with Misha Glenny, the author of McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, which has just come out in paperback from Vintage Books with a new introduction. Misha Glenny has been a correspondent for the BBC, World Service, and for a number of other major U.S. and European print and electronic media. He's written he's specialized really in Eastern Europe, especially Yugoslavia, and wrote The Rebirth of History, The Fall of Yugoslavia, and the Balkans, Nationalism, War, and the Great Powers from 1804 to 1999. Now he's covering a much wider range, but his story begins in his familiar territory in the Balkans and Russia. Welcome to Booktown, Misha.
Thank you very much, Eric.
It is very interesting that your book starts out in Russia and the Balkans and ends in China and covers almost all of the world in between. Global criminality, I guess, does cover the whole world.
It certainly does now, and has been doing for the past 20 years or so. But it was very important for me to start in the Balkans and in Bulgaria and Yugoslavia, because this is where I noticed during the turmoil of the 1990s, and in particular the wars in the former Yugoslavia, that behind the obvious motivation of nationalism and ethnic tension in the region, there was a much more sinister phenomenon in play, and that was the influence of organized crime, of people exploiting the chaos and the vacuum of power left by the fall of communism in order to make a lot of money in a very short space of time in a frankly morally dubious way. And really what happened to my mind is that the wars in Yugoslavia and the chaos in the Balkans organized crime and the desire to make money overtook nationalism as the main driving force behind these wars, and these organized criminal syndicates, together with the new business class known as the oligarchs, used the fog of war in order to establish great empires, but they did so on a sort of mountain of blood and flesh.
And you actually give very little attention to the traditional Italian, Sicilian mafia, which has been to some degree defanged in the last two decades, and what has arisen in other places in the world might be even more horrendous.
Well, it's absolutely right that I don't pay much attention to the Sicilian mafia, partly because so much has been written on the Sicilian mafia. However, I did do quite a lot of research on organized crime in Italy as background for the book, and as you point out, the Sicilian mafia in particular has been defanged to a great degree over the past two decades, really since about 1993-1994. Unfortunately, one of the consequences of that was to strengthen the other three major mafia-style organizations in southern Italy. The so-called 'Ndrangheta in Reggio Calabria, which is probably the biggest cocaine importing operation in Europe, something called the Sacra Corona Unita on the east coast of Apulia. And then, of course, in Naples, the Camorra, on which Roberto Saviano wrote his book, Camorra. Those three organizations have become very, really pretty powerful. But elsewhere, you're right, a lot of their activity has been displaced by the new mafias from the Balkans, from Eastern Europe, from Africa, and to a great extent also from China and the Far East.
We'll go into some of those regions in a minute, but as I was reading the book, I wrote down four causes for the rise of global criminality that you mentioned at different times. And I guess I have five causes. And the first was the collapse of the USSR. The second was the deregulation of banks and the process of economic globalization. The third was the sudden large numbers of ex-soldiers who didn't have anything to do. The fourth was the various prohibitions and sanctions, which we've tried to place on certain commodities or on certain governments. And the fifth is the demand of the rich, meaning folks like you and me who want our cheap goods from around the world.
Yeah. That's roughly correct. I mean, all of the points you make are very important. The fall of communism, I want to make it clear that the fall of communism was a magnificent historical event, in as much that, you know, some 250 million people had access to a degree of freedom and democratic elections which had been denied them systematically for between 50 and 70 years. So it was a good thing, but nobody anticipated what was going to happen after the collapse in communism. Certainly, people in the West had made no preparation for this eventuality. And as I said, there was this vacuum of power, a collapse of the economy, and a new economic system. So the planned economy was over, and all of a sudden you had a new market economy based on contract law in countries which had little or no experience of contract law. So without a proper police force and a proper judicial system in order to sort of nurture that market economy, those people who were strong enough, to wit, you know, sportsmen, ex-soldiers, ex-KGB personnel, took the law into their own hands and started fashioning the market economy so it benefited them. And this was the real core of why organized crime became so powerful in the former communist world. And it coincided with the liberalization, the deregulation of financial and commodity markets around the world, which came to be known as globalization. So all of a sudden, you had a huge increase in the capacity of organized crime, combined with an ability to move from territory to territory, to find new trading areas. Migration was made much easier, and so on. And as you point out, for the fifth issue, there's this question of demand in the West. If we take what happened in the Balkans became a transit zone for illicit goods and services from all over the world, straining to get into their biggest market, which was Western Europe, the European Union. And that's because, as in the United States, a large percentage of the European affluent European population likes to spend some of its leisure time and leisure cash on taking drugs, sleeping with prostitutes, and employing illegal migrant labor. And so this fantastic money that can be made out of us explains why illicit goods and services, the products of organized crime, tend to go from the developing world into the developed world.
You tend to divide the criminal organizations into two groups. One are the ones that supply services that or commodities people want that are normally illegal or hard to get. And a lot of these are, they can be cigarettes in the Balkans or cigarettes in China, or they can be harder drugs. And then there are the ones which also exist all over from Russia to Japan that primarily provide protection.
That's right. The original sense of the mafia in Italy was an organization in Sicily which provided protection for people who were trading, basically businessmen and farmers in Sicily. And what they would do, because they couldn't rely on the courts or the police, they would go to the local mafioso, who was a strong-arm person, and say, look, I want to do a deal with this other businessman, but I'm not sure that he's playing me right. Can you come and assist me? And the mafioso would go along and make sure that actually that fair play ensured. But if ensued. But if you're in that position, it's very easy as somebody who offers protection services to develop into a protection racket. You can abuse your muscle. There's no sort of accountability available. Very frequently, they graduate from providing protection services or operating a protection racket and moving into the markets themselves, both illegal and legal. And what you'll find all over the world is that you have organized criminals who are involved in illegal markets like drugs, but also in legal markets like construction. It's just that, you know, a la Sopranos, it's just that what they're doing is that they're using their muscle in order to ensure monopoly advantages in that particular branch of the economy.
You mentioned a great difference in style among some of the organizations. The Nigerians, you say, are very non-violent, or comparatively non-violent.
Comparatively.
Yeah, and the Colombians and Mexicans right now are very violent. And these are probably depend on the particular services they're offering and also on perhaps on national sensibilities.
There are local cultural aspects. If we take Colombia, for example, I ought to point out that what I did for the book was to go and visit most of the countries I write about, well, all of the countries I write about. I made a point of going to talk to organized criminals from all over the world, because what I wanted to know is what was their motivation. And in Colombia, where I met members of the FARC, the Marxist guerrilla organization, which is also a sort of drug cartel in fatigues as well, you notice very strongly that the traditions of violence in Colombia, which stretch back into the 19th century, have greatly influenced the violence associated first in the 1960s with the marijuana trade, but especially from the late 70s onward in the cocaine trade. Whereas in Nigeria, until very recently, as you rightly say, they liked to avoid violence wherever possible. The most successful organized crime groups in the world, in terms of the extent of their reach, are those which avoid the use of violence unless it's absolutely necessary. Because those people who get involved in large-scale violence very quickly find that they're losing one of their most precious resources, which is the human resource, because their muscle is being shot by the competition or the police. And what you see happening in northern Mexico at the moment is just the most appalling example of this, where basically any state authority is collapsing at a tremendous speed, and you have this anarchic situation whereby cartels are competing violently with one another for the vast profits which cocaine going to the United States secure them. But at the same time, they are co-opting parts of the state, the police force in particular, and also taking on the military by the use of violence. That situation has got completely out of control. It's no longer in the hands of the Mexican government, no longer in the hands of the organized criminals themselves, and certainly not in the hands of the police.
So is there or isn't there honor among thieves?
Do you know, it depends where you are and what the situation is, but yes, there is honor among thieves in peculiar situation. So, for example, you will see a lot of cooperation in Japan between the traditional Japanese Yakuza, three or four of whom I interviewed at great length, and the new Chinese gangsters who have a real foothold in Japan but operate there on the whole as muscle, and they are employed by the Yakuza because the Yakuza can no longer recruit young Japanese men to enter the organization. And so what the Yakuza are doing is outsourcing their muscle work to the Chinese groups of basically unemployed young Chinese men who've migrated into Japan temporarily. So you see this tremendous cooperation between a Japanese organized crime and a Chinese organized crime, despite the fact that there is a lot of hostility towards Chinese migrants on a popular level within Japan. Everywhere, with the curious exception of India, what I discovered was that people who are involved in nationalist disputes and nationalist conflicts on a political level in public, in private, you see cooperation between the organized criminal syndicates of those groups. So, for example, throughout the wars in the former Yugoslavia, whilst during the day the thieves would join with the politicians in demanding the slaughter of citizens of other nationalities, at night they would sit down and they would cooperate in their criminal business, shifting stuff across the Balkans and into the European Union. It was quite breathtaking.
The soldiers are one of the main, in certain places, not everywhere, not say in China or Japan, but in the Balkans, in Russia, and especially in Africa and parts of Latin America, it's soldiers who are no longer have a military career who supply a lot of the muscle for many of these groups.
That's absolutely right, Eric. What you see is when you have a conflict situation, for example, we can take close to my home, Northern Ireland. In order to sustain an insurgency, a guerrilla campaign, or a terrorist campaign, those organizations need to get a source of revenue. In the case of both the Republicans and the Loyalists in Northern Ireland, the most common form of revenue raising that they got involved in was dealing drugs. Now, what happens when you have in Northern Ireland, the end of the conflict, which was negotiated between the British and the Irish governments, along with the IRA and with the Loyalist paramilitary organizations, you suddenly had a lot of people, a lot of young men filled with testosterone, whose basic job in life was to be a terrorist or an insurgent, whatever you want to call them. And they had nothing to do all of a sudden. And so as the peace process came to an end, we saw a significant rise in organized criminal activity in Northern Ireland. Now, when you get to places like Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Angola, and above all else, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they control, these rebels and these violent groups control huge mineral resources for which there is a vast market in the West, then it becomes incredibly difficult once the conflict gets going to break these patterns of conflict, because you have to find jobs for the fighters to do, and usually the development situation in those countries is so poor that it's very difficult to do that. So when it comes to a post-conflict situation, whether you're invading Iraq or whatever it is you want to do, if you want to avoid organized crime, you have to have a very clear program of creating employment for those young men who were involved in the conflict or who are going to be made unemployed by your invasion. Otherwise, you will have a huge rise in the incidence of organized crime, and that has been proved time and time again.
My son Nicholas, who works at the Center for Stabilization and Reconstruction Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, walked into the studio just before we went on the air, and he's sitting here with me. He works specifically on setting up programs on disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration. He may have a few words to throw in, or he may just listen along.
Absolutely.
There are, though, places in the world where this has, the criminal elements come from completely peaceful groups or groups that were comparatively peaceful beforehand.
What sort of places are you talking? You mean countries that were relatively peaceful?
Countries that were relatively peaceful, or I'm thinking of in Russia, an awful lot of the oligarchs were had been low-level academics. And the same thing to some degree in China.
That's absolutely the case. What turns a sort of mid-level or obscure academic into an oligarch is a huge shift in economic policy. And what was interesting about those mid and low-level academics is that they often had a sort of an entrepreneurial ability to observe what was going on in society. They weren't all academics. A lot of them were movers and shakers in the sort of shadows of the Soviet economy, movers and shakers who exploited the great shift in the economy. And the same thing has happened in China. It's just, of course, that in China, political control, or a degree of political control, has been maintained by the Communist Party in the center. What's very interesting about China is in the provinces, although you have a Communist Party structure, you basically have very, very corrupt relationships between that Communist Party leadership and the new business class which has emerged.
And there are some countries where the people that we consider criminals are actually held in fairly high esteem. In China, the people we call snakeheads who import illegal immigrants into Western countries, they are not seen as preying upon their the people they move. They're not trafficking. They're actually helping them out.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's astonishing when you go to China, you actually see the local municipalities and indeed the central government setting up support organizations for people who want to migrate and by implication migrate illegally. And the snakeheads are seen by the Chinese who want to get to come to the West in order to get the opportunity to work and send money back to their homes because there isn't any work in the Chinese countryside for them or none where they can make any sort of money. They see the snakeheads as people who facilitate their dream. And very often, the snakeheads are not trafficking people against their will. They're smuggling people because that's what the people want to do. Now, they do have a fairly ruthless business model. And if you are successfully smuggled into, say, the United Kingdom or the United States, you then have a very punishing commitment in terms of paying back the costs, which can be anything up to $30,000 to the snakehead who has conveyed you to your destination. And woe betide those people who fall behind with their payments. So it's not a fun thing to do. People don't migrate for fun in order to work. They go because there isn't a labor market in the United States or in the United Kingdom. And that there are employers all over the Western world who are happy to employ illegal migrant laborers because they can employ them for very little money. And with what little profit they get, they then have to send that back to the snakehead or the snakehead's representative in Brooklyn, San Francisco, wherever it may be.
And if the immigrant dies, the immigrant's family is in real trouble.
Real trouble, because the immigrant's family... I went to interview the widows and the bereaved children of the 21 migrants, illegal migrants, who were killed in the United Kingdom about 5 years ago in a terrible tragedy called the Morecambe Bay tragedy. They were picking cockles, which are the little shellfish that are very popular up in the north of England, and they were all drowned in the most appalling situation, and they were on their mobile phones to their loved ones all the way around the world in China. The loved ones heard them on the phone as they were saying, "I'm drowning, I'm drowning." It was absolutely terrible. But even worse than that, once their husbands and their sons had died, the snakeheads and other people who had invested in them to send them to the United Kingdom demanded the money back of these people who were utterly bereft, bereaved, of course, of their husbands, but with no money whatsoever, and they live the most appalling lives of penury now. The problem throughout of organized crime is that there is generally no accountability to the shadow economy, which is what I like to call the broader economic zone within which organized crime lives. There's no sense of accountability to them whatsoever, and so if you come under their wheel, it's an utterly ruthless and destructive experience, which is why you do need regulation around the world in order to prevent the abuses associated with the shadow economy.
In Japan, the government is essentially regulating the Yakuza.
The Japanese situation is mind-boggling, frankly. Essentially, they are the organized crime groups, the Yakuza, are semi-legal there. They have to register with the police, and every year they have to submit a list of their memberships and their candidate members. The reason for this is for peculiar historical reasons. The Japanese only allow the graduation of 5,000 lawyers every year in Japan, and this means there's a chronic shortage of lawyers to deal with all sorts of things, from marital disputes through to car accidents, through to theft and so on and so forth. And a lot of people, rather than go through the tortuous experience of the Japanese courts, simply go to their local Yakuza to get a dispute resolved or to take revenge on somebody who has done them wrong. And the authorities are well aware that this takes place. And although there are occasional campaigns against the Yakuza, essentially these people live within a legal gray zone and are a fabric, part of the fabric of Japanese life, although a lot of people in Japan are, of course, very uneasy with this situation. But it is most bizarre.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, talking with Misha Glenny about his book McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld. We've only got five or so more minutes to go. We could talk the whole hour, but I'd like to come up to date on two things. One is how these various crime organizations, how they interact around the world, and then find out a little bit about what's happened since you wrote the book.
Well, in terms of the interaction, what you used to have with the Sicilian mafia is basically the classic mafias were all based on loyalties, clan hierarchies, very strictly delineated with a system of how the family works and so on. What happened in the early 90s when you got all sorts of new mafias moving in and you saw a great increase in business all around the world was that, on the whole, that system of hierarchy, family loyalties, was dispensed with in favor of what we call transactional loyalty. And that is that most organized crime syndicates now are highly decentralized operations. This is certainly the case in Colombia and in Russia. And what that means is that you can do a deal with your opposite number in Italy or in Nigeria or South Africa, and then you can, when it comes to the next deal, you can shift to another operation, and nobody gets upset about that. It was very interesting to see in The Sopranos. The Sopranos is really a very smart series in terms of the changing nature of organized crime. There's a point where Tony Soprano realizes that his nephew, Christopher Moltisanto, who's like a son to him, of course, his antics are making Tony's operation ever more vulnerable to attacks from outside. And when they have a car crash, Tony Soprano decides that this is the time that he actually has to kill his nephew, despite the fact that that breaks every law in the mafia code. And it is at that moment that Tony Soprano leaves the old-style mafia behind and becomes part of the new mafia, who are interested only in transactions. And anything that threatens the profit or the security of the company, even if it is a nephew of the boss, has to go.
So how about the current state of the world? When you wrote this book, you were just seeing the first inklings of the global economic crisis. When the paperback came out, things had gotten a lot worse. But now they're still worse, and we can see that so much of the problems that plague the more or less legitimate world stem from misfeasance by the banks, and it looks like the same is true of the underworld.
That's absolutely true. What happened in September, in the when the Lehman Brothers collapse happened in the world of organized crime, was really interesting. You saw a fall in the provision of commodities and services like recreational drugs or prostitution. There was a drop in that because people didn't have as much money to spend on that sort of thing. But you've got a very significant increase in two or three sectors. One is cybercrime, which is a whole story in itself, but which is at the moment the fastest rising sector of international organized crime. And it is becoming very sophisticated indeed. Partly related to that is the issue of identity theft and fraud in general. We've seen a big increase in fraud cases in Europe and the United States and elsewhere in the world since last September. And then the other two things first of all, the Madoff case and the Alan Stanford cases demonstrated to us that there was organized criminal activity, because there's no other way of describing what Madoff and Alan Stanford were up to, organized criminal activity right in the very heart of Wall Street. And it was criminal activity which the regulatory authorities were completely unable to detect. Now, I know from talking to police forces here in Europe that they are looking at several other major cases of that ilk at the moment. So there is much more to come on that. That basically, the banking system was cankered with respect to organized crime, as well as in respect to the speculative orgy which has led us to the current situation. But the final thing, which is almost competing with cybercrime and is a big, big problem in the long term for relations between the West and China, is the issue of counterfeit goods. We have in Europe now an avalanche of counterfeit goods coming into the European Union, mainly from East Asia, and it's no longer the traditional commodities like DVDs and Louis Vuitton luxury bags. It's anything from Gillette shaving cream through Duracell batteries. Anything that can be made is being copied in China and going on to the world markets. And this is problematic for the West's relations with China, because over the past 20 years we've thrown almost all of our manufacturing jobs over to China, and we're dependent on the creative industries and service industries, and counterfeit goods undermines that. And that's why this issue causes so much tension in the world at the moment, but is going to cause more.
And then there's the whole question of money laundering, which I think it almost seems has come to seem in the last year that the world banking system is almost created for that purpose.
Well, it certainly benefited it immensely during the 1990s, which was the golden age of money laundering. You could shift anything anywhere. What we've seen in Italy is, with the drying up of credit from the banks, You've seen a resurgence of the Sicilian mafia, but the Camorra and the Ndrangheta are making hay out of this. They're not just loan sharking. I mean, there's a lot of loan sharking going on now all over the world that wasn't a year ago. But in Italy, what they're doing is that organized crime is lending to small and medium-sized businesses because they can't get money from the banks. And the big issue is when you have a credit crunch in the illicit banking world, then people who need money look to where the cash-rich economy is. And the world of organized crime is nothing if not a cash-rich economy. So it is making hay out of the current crisis. It is able to switch its trading. The syndicates are able to switch their trading from commodities like drugs into financial services and stuff like that, because they don't have any regulatory bodies at all. So they don't have to apply for a license if they want to change their line of business. And they have responded with skill and alacrity to the chaos that our financial institutions have created.
Whatever you can say about global criminals, they are very clever people.
They are very smart. They're watching the economy very, very closely. And they're certainly making more money than you or me.
I can't deny that. Thanks so much, Misha, for talking with us.
You're more than welcome, Eric. Nice to talk to you. Okay.
That was Misha Glenny, author of McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, which has just come out in paperback from Vintage Books.
How do I hold my temper, keep it my grace, and not become bitter, stuck in this infamous place? I remember even at 7, when I dreamed of a better place, a better race than the human race. Stuck in this infamous place without a trace, only a history of misery and indentured slavery. I pledge no allegiance to this flag, and free I let my pen sag. I am the little black boy's soul, taken from his mother's bosom and sold, while the old one still linked to Africa kills the white ones with his head down and eyes closed. Stuck in this infamous place without a trace, only a history of misery and indentured slavery. I pledge no allegiance to this flag, and free I let my pen sag. I am John Lennon, who spoke of one race, one place. I am Mother Teresa, unafraid of any gunner. I am Martin Luther King, shot down on the balcony in the midst of his dreams. I am Malcolm S, betrayed by the beastie and burnt surreptitiously. Stuck in this infamous place without a trace, only a history of misery and indentured slavery. I pledge no allegiance to this flag, and free I let my pen sag. I am the one not mentioned in your constitution as human. Not allowed to vote until it made no difference. Job is just an old metaphor. A true warrior was a slave, and John Brown a true hero of a brave. I am Emmett Till, hung from a beautiful oak tree. Stuck in this infamous place without a trace. Only a history of misery and indentured slavery. I pledge no allegiance to this flag and free. I let my pen sag.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. With me in the studio right now is Sherry Snook, who's helped organize what's going to be an incredible event tomorrow afternoon, tomorrow evening, looking at, well, in the first half of this program, we talked about what we call criminality from an economic point of view, from a world political point of view. But Sherry's going to talk to us about the human side of the people that, for one reason or another, we consider criminal.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me and the mystery guest on today. And I think everything happens for a reason. And this concert tomorrow in the afternoon at 11 o'clock, this concert from Sweden, Stockholm, Sweden, the Jabra Roster Choir consists of 31 members with the conductor and composer Stefan Sävsten, who has taken the poetry of the prisoner who's serving a life term sentence, Spoon Jackson, who is incarcerated at New Folsom Prison. And they will be playing and performing inside the prison tomorrow. And it's the first time Spoon will have seen the choir in real life performing his words and Stefan's music that they combined together. And then they will be coming here to perform here at the Miners Foundry, 325 Spring Street. And it will be a live broadcast on KVMR. And it's going to be an extraordinary, spectacular, very unique story to be put on stage. And the music itself by Stefan is incredible. I spent the day in Danville yesterday when they started their tour and performed at the Peace Lutheran Church of the Full House. And it was absolutely incredible with a standing ovation, tears of joy. And the lyrics are put into the program. So when you come to the concert, you will be able to read each and every word that's sung in English by the Swedish choir. And the Jabra Roster Choir has been touring around the country from Italy, Rome, Germany. They've performed before the Pope. They've been going for quite some years, and Stefan has met Spoon through writing pen pals in this past 7 years, and only met him just about 2 years ago for the first time after they created the very first CD called Freedom for the Prisoners when he was in San Quentin.
Now, you must have been instrumental in setting this up. I know you've been going to Folsom for years to work with the prisoners.
Yeah,
specifically on writing questions.
In the arts and corrections, I've been working with the program, volunteering and helping to bring other members of our community of Nevada City into New Folsom in the arts program. And as some may have known and some that don't know of Michael Franti and Spearhead, that became the National Historic Broadcast, that became the similar showcasing of just like when Johnny Cash had gone in. And it was a very, very huge big deal here at KVMR and around the globe as we were broadcasting live that evening. And other amazing people have gone into the prison just locally. Grace Tothrow has been going in and teaching the poetry programs along with Lorraine Webb, and other guest appearance from people from Alaska, poets, musicians continue to come on a regular basis. So tomorrow's event for this choir to come in is a very huge event. It's the first time ever to bring an enormous amount of people in. There'll be 50 people all together. There's 31 choir members, and the SF San Francisco Sound Orchestra will be performing with them, and they will be here tomorrow night as well. So it's a huge, huge feat for the prison to allow this to happen, but they believe in programming. They believe and they know that 90% of these men and women will be leaving prison. They're leaving faster and faster each and every day. And having programs like this helps them to be more ready, safe for our society. It helps them to build a better self esteem, and just to be ready to come back into society, because they're dealing with arts that, like, you know, right here in our own community, we deal with art in so many ways: music, poetry, writings, and that's what sustains our community. So therefore, it's another community of people who are finding a better way to live their life and to be better people, so when they come out, they have something to hold on to of what they found, what's good about them. So this is a very huge event tomorrow. Yeah.
Have you worked yourself with Spoon Jackson?
I have. I see Spoon probably 3-4 times a month. My daughter actually visits Spoon and has helped encourage her writing, and she is an amazing writer herself, and because of Spoon's help and encouragement, he has really helped to help her to develop in writing, and he's worked with other schools as well with poetry classes.
And did you have anything to do with getting his words to Sweden?
No, actually, two members of the choir had retrieved Spoon's poetry. He was in Waiting for Godot play in San Quentin some years ago, and the producer of that has gone to speak in public speaking for years about the work in San Quentin, and Spoon has become quite famous and become the international poet. And so they had brought to Stefan some poetry and said, can you write some music to this? And when Stefan read the poems, he actually cried and heard the music, and he said he never wrote music so quickly when he read Spoon's poetry.
Why is he back in Folsom now, New Folsom?
Well, some people have this thought that when prisoners go to prison, they're in one prison. They could spend, if they're in there for life, doesn't matter how long they're in for, you could move from prison to prison to prison. It's not about, they don't call it home, they call it their cell. They move around a lot.
I had this fear that maybe if he's in for life, I thought, was he, earlier, did he have a death sentence? Or
no, he's just serving life without parole.
And they just take him from place to place.
Yeah, and because of the Arts and Corrections Program, he's afforded to be able to stay in this program because he helps to teach other prisoners, the younger prisoners that come in. He helps to give them a direction to learn about poetry and writing and keep them into programs. So he's kind of the rooted part of the source of the Arts and Corrections Program. So a lot of other prisons send people to come to this prison to learn about how to do programming. I look at California State Prison Sacramento as the KVMR. People want to be a lot like KVMR, and a lot of people want to have like the kind of programming that CSP SAC has, and they go there and to learn about it. So we have a very unique gift of KVMR being able to have this red carpet open door to go into the prison and to build this bridge for us to go in and for the prisoners to come out through music and through poetry and through writing. And some do come to our community when they get out to come and see us in real life, and they listen to KVMR, and they are very appreciative of the connection of the creativity that we offer them. So, big kudos to KVMR and our relations for what we do as a community to make such things happen.
So very quickly, when are these events going to be? Tomorrow is going to be first at the prison and then in Nevada City.
Correct. They'll be arriving, and the performance begins at 8 o'clock. Doors open at 7:30. And after yesterday's performance, a generous donor came forth and said, no one should be turned away for this event. And if you are thinking that you can't come because of lack of funds, if you're a senior or a child, anyone, that please come to the door, put your name down, and someone's buying your ticket to attend. And it's a very generous offer because they see the value in this. So I thank them for that. And again, it's at the Foundry right here next to KVMR. And it is a live broadcast for those who can't attend. We are in a very busy little town, and I know a lot of people will be doing other things as well, but you can tune in at 8 p.m. for a live broadcast.
Thanks so much, Sherry.
Thanks,
for coming
Eric.
In. This was very fortuitous.
Thank you very much.
This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.